Hello, I'm Marlene Saeed. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera. This week, a $60 a barrel price gap on Russian oil set by the G7 and a ban by the EU on Russian seaborne oil comes into effect. What impact will it have on the Kremlin's ability to finance the war in Ukraine? Also this week, political instability and increased uncertainty over the future of South Africa's president has cast a shadow over the country's flagging economy. Conservationists in India are raising the alarm about the danger of shrimp farming to the environment. We find out what they say the problems are. The first phase of the European Union's ban on Russian crude oil and petroleum products kicked in this week. European countries will stop buying seaborne crude oil from Russia with limited exceptions, robbing the Kremlin of revenues that it needs to sustain its war efforts in Ukraine. The embargo comes at the same time as a price cap on Russian oil. That's been backed by the group of seven advanced economies. Let's take a look at the new measures in a little more detail. The EU, the G7 and Australia have all agreed to cap the price of Russian oil at $60 a barrel. The EU will also ban Russian seaborne crude oil imports from December 5th and refined oil products from February the 5th. The ban covers 90% of the EU's oil imports from Russia. Worth noting, last year, the EU imported about $74 billion worth of crude oil and refined petroleum products from Russia. The embargo also prohibits European companies from insuring and financing shippers carrying Russian oil above that price cap. To discuss all of this, I'm joined now from Dubai by Robin Mills. Robin is a non-resident fellow at Columbia SIPA Centre on Global Energy Policy and the Chief Executive Officer of Kamar Energy. Thank you for joining the programme, Robin. Let's start with the price cap of $60 a barrel on Russian crude. What is the idea behind this plan?
Well, really, the concept is that the G7, they want to keep Russian oil on the market, because they don't want to have a damaging spike in prices by cutting off Russian supply, but they also don't want too many revenues to go back to Vladimir Putin's government. So the idea is to allow the Russians to sell, but only at a capped price, and to restrict sales of oil at above that cap by restricting the access to shipping and insurance services, most of which is provided by G7 countries and particularly by European countries.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, is it going to be easy to enforce? What is the role of the insurance companies in this?
Well, the insurance companies are absolutely essential, because no vessel can sail or enter ports or go through major waterways without having reliable insurance, because obviously there's a huge danger of accidents, and then a major oil spill could cost billions of dollars in cleanup. So these cargoes have to be properly insured. If they're going to enter ports, or if they're going to go through waterways like the Bosphorus or the Suez Canal, so that the insurance side of it is absolutely critical.
Okay, so this is a good plan, is it? I mean, will it have a significant impact on Russia's oil profits, which is what they want?
Well, you know, the odd thing is now that most of the Russian oil exports are actually trading below the cap. Prices have fallen quite sharply the past couple of weeks, and Russian oil was already selling at a significant discount. Now, how much of that discount is due to buyers being reluctant to take Russian oil? How much is due to them seeing the price cap and using their negotiating leverage? Probably a bit of both. But actually, as we see, the discounted prices below the cap already. But the advocates of the cap would say, well, it's good. That's exactly the effect we want to have.
If global oil prices start going back up, presumably that will really hurt Russia.
If prices go up again and the G7 are able to stick to the cap and enforce it rigidly and keep the $60, then Russia will be losing out on significant upside in revenues, absolutely. I think the question is even more the other way. What if prices keep falling and the price that Russia is receiving stays below the cap? Will the G7 think, oh, well, we could tighten this further. We could make the cap $55 or $50 a barrel, depending where Russian oil is actually trading. They do have a mechanism to keep reviewing the cap and changing it as required.
OK, so let's talk a bit more detail about the EU ban on the seaborne crude oil. What impact will that have on Russia?
The EU has always been Russia's major oil customer, of course. Now the EU, as 5th of December, it introduced a nearly complete ban on purchases of Russian crude, a pretty much complete ban on seaborne crude, and an effective ban on a lot of pipeline imports into Eastern Europe. that has a major impact because Russia then has to look for other markets. And it's really got a couple of other markets outside the EU and the UK and the US, which have also banned Russian oil shipments. And that's really India and China. And over the course of this year, India has been the main partner there in picking up a lot more Russian oil and filling this gap. China has taken a bit more. Turkey has taken some more. But Russia, I think, will have to look more widely and find other customers if it's going to replace all of the European oil market that's now lost, effectively.
I guess the other key question is, how is the EU going to make up the shortfall? I mean, the bloc, I believe, will need to replace about 1 million barrels of crude per day. Can the EU manage to really do without all this Russian oil?
Yeah, it's a logistical issue, but there is the oil on the market. So we've already, again, seen this year that European oil trade has switched around considerably. And we've seen a major increase, not surprisingly, of Middle East oil going into Europe, particularly Saudi oil, Iraqi oil. Obviously, the US has increased as well. So, and between those various sources, the EU has so far managed to replace what it's cut down from Russia. So we expect that to continue. There are some logistical issues. How do you get oil to landlocked refineries in Central and Eastern Europe that used to get it via pipeline from Russia? There's been some efforts to reconfigure pipelines and change things. There's been some exemptions for refineries in countries like Hungary that claim they can't easily get non-Russian oil. But those things are being sorted out over time.
So what are Russia's options here? Do they comply with the price caps? Do they have other alternatives, like providing their own tankers, their own insurers, and so on?
Well, Russia has said that they won't comply with the price cap and that they won't sell to anybody who is complying. Of course, they have to say that. They can't accept this as a policy. I think they may find that, at least quietly, they have to accept that if they're going to continue selling, that they'll have to implicitly accept the existence of the price cap and that some of their buyers will want to comply with it. Russia has been trying to accumulate a large shadow fleet of tankers over the past few months of its own tankers by buying secondhand and older tankers that it could replace the usual fleet with. That will certainly fill some of its needs, but not all of it. It's a much longer voyage for Russia to go from a Russian port on the Black Sea or the Baltic to India than it was to sail for a few days to a European port. So therefore, it needs much more tankers to do those deliveries to Asia. So the shadow fleet won't entirely solve the problem for Russia. Russia has also been trying to set up new insurance schemes and offer its own insurance. We'll see how widely that's accepted. Are these Russian insurance schemes really accepted as valid by all major
ports?
What do you
think?
And waterways?
Is that a good alternative for them? Do you think that might work?
I think some what we're seeing so far, for example, the Turkish authorities seem to be accepting the Russian insurance. And so Russian tankers are able to get out of the Black Sea. We'll have to see whether all ports are willing to take that. I think at least India and China probably will accept it because they obviously want to keep the Russian oil flowing. But I think we've got to think that there will be some limitation to Russian oil flows because of the lack of an adequate tanker fleet and a lot of other tankers not in the Russian fleet who will want to avoid the problem entirely by not carrying Russian oil at all.
Okay, clearly some unknowns on how this will all pan out. But what do you think? I mean, in terms of the impact, the global impact on the price of oil, where do you think that's going to go in the short term and in the long term?
Well, you know, we're actually seeing prices continue to fall. I think partly because the market has felt confident that this price cap won't have a significant impact on reducing Russian supplies, partly because of fears about recession and Chinese COVID lockdowns and so on that are outside the price cap issue, but that are hitting demand. You know, prices are Brent crude prices now below $70, below $80 per barrel, below where they were at the start of the year, even before the war. So that's hitting Russia, even without the effect of the price cap. I think in the longer term, though, this will reduce Russian oil exports. The price cap enforcement will get cleverer, and the Russians also try and find ways around it, of course. So it'll be a bit of a cat and mouse game.
And the consumers, are they the winners or the losers of this EU scheme?
Well, so far they're winners because the oil prices are coming down pretty strongly. But as I say, I don't think that's really affected the price cap. It's other economic factors going on. But I think, that, again, the designers of the price cap would say, well, we've brought in a price cap, no serious damage so far. Russian revenues are being cut anyway, so the policy is working. But I think there is a concern, yes, going into the start of next year, that there could be a more serious impact on prices. Particularly if the Chinese demand picks up. And also, we also have to bear in mind that this is about crude oil, but at the start of February next year, the EU ban on refined oil products comes into effect. And that is a significantly harder problem how do you replace the exports of Russian fuels, like diesel in particular?
Really, really interesting to get your thoughts. Robin Mills, non-resident fellow at Columbia Supercenter, Global Energy Policy and the Chief Executive Officer of Kamar Energy. Thank you.
Thank you.
South Africa's National Assembly has delayed a parliamentary vote that could lead to the president's impeachment until next week. President Cyril Ramaphosa is facing allegations of serious misconduct in relation to a large amount of cash found at his game farm after a robbery 3 years ago. Ramaphosa has denied any wrongdoing and has not been charged with any crimes. The scandal has spooked the markets with growing fears of a prolonged period of political instability. Investors were hoping for reforms to boost the country's flagging economy. They fear that his replacement could increase government spending and take on more debt. Well, despite skyrocketing interest rates, food and fuel prices, South Africa's economy actually grew faster than expected in the third quarter by 1.6% in the 3 months to the end of September. That's thanks to a surge in agriculture, forestry and fishing. The economy is actually bigger now than before the coronavirus pandemic struck. But the country is facing an increasing number of blackouts after electricity supplier Eskom announced it wouldn't be able to refuel its diesel generators until at least April next year. Now, those generators were meant to help the country's aging state-owned power grid and its mainly coal-fueled power stations to keep up with demand. Well, South Africa's government is now continuing with efforts to boost the amount of solar power generation in the country. Joining me now from London is Alish Montana. He is the Africa Analyst and Research Associate at risk intelligence company Verisk Maplecroft. Thank you for joining the programme, Alish. So, faster than expected growth of 1.6% in the third quarter of this year. Were you surprised by these figures?
The figures were quite surprising, and they represent a notable shift from the contraction of 0.7% that we saw in the second quarter of 2022. This is above the predicted values for the last quarter, and it positions South Africa's economy at pre-COVID-19 pandemic levels. This was thanks to the positive evolution of different areas in South Africa's economy, including in the mining sector, which increased production, benefiting from high commodity prices in global markets. We also see that the elimination of all restrictions linked to the pandemic enabled for the expansion of the tourism and hospitality sectors. Finally, international trade also increased, allowing South Africa to improve its position in the current account balances.
Okay, so better than expected growth figures there. South Africa's central bank, though, says the country's economy needs to actually expand consistently at 5% for years in order to create jobs and lower unemployment rate and so on. Is that a realistic target?
Well, so although it has been a positive progress, South Africa's economy, it's not out of the woods yet. And the economy and investors in South Africa will remain exposed to a huge political uncertainty and electricity cuts that will complicate the economic recovery from the last two crises that hit the country, such as the pandemic and most recently, the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war. In addition, we have to remember that South Africa remains exposed to external market shocks, such as the inflationary pressures that have been worsened by the Russia-Ukraine pandemic, and that will complicate South Africa's path to economic recovery.
Yeah, I'll pick you up on the inflation threat. I mean, that's a problem that countries around the world are struggling with. And like many of those countries, the government in South Africa, well, the central bank in South Africa has been aggressively putting up interest rates. How is that working for them?
So the consistent increases in interest rates aim to soften the inflationary pressures that we were talking about. We see that inflation has slowed down slightly over the past few months. However, it reached record values of 7.8% last July. This is well above the target range of inflation set by the central bank, which is between 3 and 6% in order to protect the value of the South African rand. We therefore expect the central bank to continue increasing interest rates until it reaches the desired values. And although it seems like it's a mitigating part of the inflationary pressures, it also has the side effect of slowing down growth, which will, as I was mentioning before, continue to complicate South Africa's economic recovery entering the new year.
It's a very difficult balancing act, isn't it? Let's talk about Eskom, which is South Africa's electricity public utility company, a vital business for South Africa. It's announced it has no funds left to acquire diesel until April 2023. How big a problem is this? How much is it going to cost people's lives and the economy?
Yes, so we see that access to electricity in South Africa will remain constrained by fiscal inefficiencies and rampant corruption in Eskom. The announcement that they have run out of funds to acquire diesel will be disruptive and will lead to blackouts becoming more frequent and more intense over the following months, with load shedding level 4 becoming a common scenario in the country. We see that the company uses diesel to run some of its auxiliary plants activated during periods of peak consumption or emergencies, which will limit the capacity of the company to react to unexpected circumstances. This will expose companies from the operating in the country to electricity cuts, or will force them to invest in generating their own energy independently.
These allegations of corruption against President Cyril Ramaphosa have been very much dominating headlines at the moment. To what extent do foreign investors pay attention to headlines like those, and of course about the electricity company that we were just talking about? How much does it impact the economy?
Yes, so investors will face increases in government stability risks and also potential increases in civil unrest as a result of the political scandals in South Africa's government. We see that the ANC has been in decline over the past few years in terms of public support, and will therefore increase the risk of a coalition government in 2024. This is something that investors will keep in mind, and it will expose them to significant political risks and also civil unrest risks stemming from increase in public discontent.
What is your outlook for South Africa's economy in the long term?
So yeah, as I was mentioning, in the long term, the economy will not only suffer external shocks, but will also be exposed to the political climate in South Africa. We see that the unresolved social risks could also lead to disruptive protests. For example, in July last year, we saw that the imprisonment of Jacob Zuma triggered protests in the country. And while these protests were sparked by a political factor, they were pretty much fueled by underlying unresolved issues such as unemployment, inequality, and poverty. We see that the government has been unable to resolve these issues and therefore will continue to fuel protests and increase the risks of disruption for businesses.
Really good to get your thoughts. Alish Montana, Africa analyst and research associate at risk intelligence company VRisk Maplecroft. Thank you.
Thank you.
Shrimp farming is a profitable business in India, but conservationists say that it's endangering the environment. They say the government should encourage more sustainable cultivation. The country is one of 5 nations that signed a pact at the UN climate summit in Egypt to protect mangrove forests. Pavni Mittal reports from the southern state of Kerala.
There are few signs of life bubbling under. The technology is expensive. Electricity is needed round the clock to maintain oxygen levels. The tank is actively monitored for temperature and nutrition. Rakesh Menon started shrimp farming last year. He says this modern method is more profitable.
In the natural pond where you're doing the low density, here we are doing it in the high density. At the same time, in a year, we are doing like 4 culture in a year. If you compare it with the natural one, they are doing it twice in a year. So that is the more difference, and where you can do more culture at the same time where you can earn more profitable in this.
Shrimp cultivation is big business in the southern Indian state of Kerala. The government is promoting it by subsidizing land and giving technical support to farmers. But mangroves are being cleared to make way for them. Kerala's forest cover has reached a historic low. In some areas, there are more shrimp farms than mangroves. Most of what remains is privately owned and unprotected.
Mangroves have been globally recognized as one of the best ways to counter climate change. They absorb more carbon than other tropical forests and also protect coastlines from natural disasters such as tsunamis. Scientists say that depletion is threatening ecosystems and local economies.
Arun Kumar has been fishing in this river for decades. He says the growing number of shrimp farms has affected his business. There are fewer fish to catch and some species have gone extinct.
Farmers use chemicals to kill all the organisms in the water. This is done before they put the shrimp seeds. This water then flows into the river. This is killing the fish. There was one fish called Kuruappa. It's not there anymore.
Conservationists want the state government to step up mangrove protection. They say these can coexist with shrimp farms.
We have to do sustainable shrimp farming, and we have traditional method of shrimp farming prevalent in Kerala, and now the non-traditional, more intensive shrimp farming is changing the geomorphology of the area, and even the restoration becomes difficult in these landscapes.
Menon says shrimp grown this way is better, and other farmers will switch to this method. But conservationists warn unchecked farming could wipe away critical forest cover and endanger thousands of lives.
Thousands of birds have been culled across Peru and Ecuador after the discovery of a strain of avian flu. Poultry farms and animal markets have been affected, and the economies of both nations have taken a knock. Mariana Sanchez has more.
A 90-day national health emergency in Peru and Ecuador as migratory birds from North America bring with them the highly contagious avian or bird flu. They've been infecting wild birds on their path towards the southern continent. The threat became clear after birds were found dead along Peru's northern coast, at least 13,000 of them, say environmental authorities, mostly pelicans. The outbreak reached a poultry farm in northern Lima, where Peru's Agricultural Health Service says nearly 37,000 birds were slaughtered this week to control the spread. But in Ecuador, it was much worse. The government says at least 180,000 birds will have to be culled to protect the poultry sector, which generates 23% of Ecuador's agricultural GDP.
This outbreak is contained. All protocols are being applied so that it does not spread. In the 5-kilometer buffer zone, there are no more contaminated farms.
Commercial producers in both countries say they have taken strict measures to secure their farm perimeters. Peru's government has banned live bird markets. The industry accounts for 2% of its GDP, and it's the most consumed protein among low-income Peruvians.
The worst thing that can happen is that this spreads to commercial farms. If chickens and hens die, chicken prices will skyrocket, and it will no longer be a health but a famine issue.
Health officials say the H5N1 avian flu strain found in Peru could infect humans through close contact. Health officials say that transmission of this virus among humans is very rare, but they're worried because the summer season here is about to begin, and they're urging people who are already coming to the beach to stay away from any dead birds. Concerned neighbors at Punta Hermosa Beach, south of Lima, say the stench of dead birds is too close.
We've called different entities to come and clean up. They came one day and took some dead birds and never came back. People come and try and see the birds, and we want to prevent this from happening too.
Authorities here and in Ecuador say they are working fast to contain the outbreak. A silent epidemic, but with no treatment or cure, death is assured for these birds reaching ashore for a time to rest their beak.
And that is our show for this week. Do get in touch with us by tweeting me at Marlene Saeed. Do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or you can drop us an email, countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. And there's lots more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That will take you straight to our website, which has lots of individual reports, links and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Marlene Saeed from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera coming up next.